shoulders into me, nearly causing me to fall. I laugh. And so does she.
What are you guys doing?
Sam asks. He's annoyed with our little game.
We're supposed to be quiet, remember?
We make it to the truck, which is parked behind a dilapidated old barn that looks as though it's ready to collapse. Six releases Sam's hand, and he climbs into the middle of the cab. Six jumps behind the wheel, and I slide in next to Sam, with BK at my feet.
Holy crap, dude, what happened to your hair?
I goad Sam.
Shut up.
Six starts the truck, and I smile as she steers us onto the road, flicking on the headlights when the wheels touch the asphalt.
What?
Sam asks. I was just thinking that, out of the four of us, three are aliens, two are fugitives, with terrorist ties, and not a single one of us has a valid driver's license. Something tells me things might get interesting. Even Six can't help but smile at this. Chapter 4.
I was 13 when they caught up to us,
Six says when we cross into Tennessee, 15 minutes after leaving the Trucksville Motel behind. I'd asked her to tell us about how she and Katerina were captured.
We were in West Texas after fleeing Mexico because of a stupid mistake. We had both been completely entranced by some stupid internet post that Two had written, though we didn't know it was by Two at the time. And we responded. We were lonely in Mexico, living in some dusty town in the middle of nowhere, and we just had to know if it really was a member of the guard.
I nod, knowing what she's talking about. Henri had also seen the blog post while we were in Colorado. I had been in a school spelling bee, and the scar had come while I was on stage. I'd been rushed to the hospital, and the doctor saw the first scar, and the fresh burn all the way to the bone of the second. When Henri arrived, they'd accused him of child abuse, which was the catalyst behind our fleeing the state and assuming new identities. Another new start.
9, now 8.
Are the rest of you out there? I ask.
That's the one.
So you guys are the ones who responded, I say. Henri had taken screenshots of the post so I could see it. He had tried furiously to hack the computer to delete it before the damage could be done, but he hadn't been quick enough. Two was killed. Somebody else deleted the post right after. We'd assumed it was the Mogadorians.
Katerina did, simply writing, "We are here," and not a minute later the scar appeared.
Six says, shaking her head.
It was so stupid of Two to post that, knowing she was next. I still can't understand why she'd risk it.
Do you guys know where she was?
Sam asks. I look at Six. Do you? Henri thought it was England, but he couldn't say for sure.
No idea. All we knew was that if they'd gotten to her that quickly, it wouldn't take long for them to get to us.
But how do you even know she posted it?
Sam asks. Six glances at him.
What do you mean?
I don't know. You guys can't even say for sure where she was. So how do you know it was her?
Who else would it be?
Well, I mean, I watch the way you and John are so cautious. I can't imagine either of you doing something so stupid like that if you knew you were next. Especially with everything you know about the Mogadorians. I don't think you would have posted something to begin with.
True, Sam.
So maybe they had already captured Two and were trying to draw some of you guys out before they killed her. Which could explain why she was killed seconds after you responded. It could have been a bluff. Or maybe she knew what they were doing, and she killed herself to warn you guys away or something. Who knows? Those are just some guesses, right?
Right, I say. But they are good guesses. Ones I hadn't thought about. Ones I wonder if Henri had. We ride in silence thinking about it. Six drives the speed limit, and a few cars cruise past us. The highway itself is lined with overhead lights that make the rolling hills beyond look spooky. She could have been scared and desperate, I say. That could have led her to do something stupid like write a careless post on the internet. Sam shrugs.
Just seems kind of unlikely to me.
But they could have already killed her, Sapon. And she could have become frantic. She must have been 12, maybe 13. Imagine being 13 and on your own. I say before I realize I'm describing Six's exact scenario. She glances at me, then turns back to the road.
We never once thought it was a trick, she says. Though it kind of makes sense. Back then we were just scared and my ankle was on fire. Kind of hard to think straight when it feels as though your foot is being sawed off.
I nod my head gravely.
But even after the initial fear, we still didn't consider that angle. We replied, which is what put them on our tail. It was ridiculous for us to do.
Maybe you're right, Sam. I can only hope we've grown a little wiser, those of us still left. Her last sentence hangs in the air. There are only six of us left. Six of us against any number of them, and no way of knowing how we might possibly find one another. We're the only hope. Strength in numbers. The power of six. The thought makes my heart pump at twice its normal speed.
What?
Six asks. There are six of us left.
I know there are, so what?
Six of us, and maybe some of the others still have their sapons, maybe they don't. But six to fight, who knows how many Mogadorians? 1,000? 100,000? 1,000,000?
Hey, don't forget about me, Sam says. And Bernie Kosar.
I nod. Sorry, Sam, you're right. 8 of us. And then all of a sudden I remember something else.
Six,
do you know about the second ship that left Lorien?
A ship aside from ours?
Yeah, it left after ours. Or at least, I think it did. Loaded with Chimera. 15 or so, and 3 Sapon. And maybe a baby. I had visions of it when Henri and I were training, though he was skeptical. But so far, all my visions have proven true.
I had no idea.
It took off in an old rocket that kind of looked like a NASA shuttle. You know, powered by fuel that left a trail of smoke behind it.
Then it wouldn't have made it here,
Six says.
Yeah, that's what Henri said.
Chimera?
Sam asks.
The same kind of animal as Bernie Kosar?
I nod. He perks up.
Maybe that's how Bernie made it here.
Could you imagine if they all made it, after seeing what Bernie did during the fight?
It'd be amazing, I agree. But I'm pretty sure old Bernie here was on our ship. I run my hand down the length of Bernie Kosar's back, and can feel matted scab still covering most of his body. Sam sighs, leans back in his seat with a look of relief on his face. Probably imagining an army of Chimera coming to our aid at the last minute to defeat the Mogadorians. Six looks into the rearview mirror, and the headlights from the car behind us illuminate a band of light across her face. She looks back to the road wearing the same introspective gaze that Henri always did when driving.
The Mogadorians?
She begins softly, swallowing as Sam and I turn our attention to her.
They caught up to us the day after we responded to Two's post, in a desolate town in West Texas. Katerina had driven 15 straight hours from Mexico, and it was getting late, and we were both exhausted because neither of us had slept. We stopped at a motel off the highway, not all that different from the one we just left. It was in a tiny town that looked like something out of an old Western movie, full of cowboys and ranchers. There were even hitching posts outside some of the buildings so that the people could tie up their horses. It was very weird. But we had just come from a dusty town in Mexico, so we didn't think twice about stopping.
She pauses as a car cruises past us. She follows it with her eyes and checks the speedometer before turning back to the road.
We went to get something to eat at a diner. About halfway through our meal, a man entered and took a seat. He was wearing a white shirt and tie, but it was a Western tie and his clothes looked outdated. We ignored him, even though I noticed the others in the diner staring at him, the same way they were staring at us. At one point he turned and gazed our way. But since everyone else had done the same, I didn't piece it together. I was only 13 then, and it was hard to think of anything at that point other than sleep and food. So we finished eating and went back to our room. Katerina jumped into the shower, and when she stepped out, wrapped in a robe, there was a knock at the door. We looked at each other. She asked who it was, and the man answered that he was the motel manager and had brought fresh towels and ice. And without thinking twice, I walked to the door and opened it.
"Oh, no," Sam says.
Six nods.
It was the man from the diner with the Western tie. He walked straight into the room and shut the door. I was wearing my pendant in plain view. He knew immediately who I was, and Katerina and I knew immediately who he was. In one fluid motion, he pulled a knife from the waistband of his trousers and swung for my head. He was fast, and I had no time to react. I had no legacies yet, no defenses. I was dead. But then the weirdest thing happened. As the knife dug into my skull, it was his skull that split open. I didn't feel a thing. I learned later they had no idea how the charm worked, that he couldn't kill me until numbers 1 through 5 were dead. He dropped to the ground and burst into ash.
"Wicked," Sam says.
"Wait," I interrupt. "From what I've seen, Mogadorians are pretty recognizable. Their skin is so white it looks bleached, and their teeth and eyes..." I trail off. "How could you not have known it in the diner? Why do you let him into the room?"
"I'm pretty sure only the scouts and soldiers look like that. They're the Mogadorians' version of the military. That's what Katerina said anyway. The rest of them look as much like normal humans as we do. The one who came into the diner looked like an accountant, wearing wire-rimmed glasses, black slacks, and a white short-sleeved dress shirt, and that tie. He even had a really dorky mustache. I remember him being tan. We had no idea they had followed us."
"That's reassuring," I say sarcastically. I replay the image of the knife plunging into Six's skull and killing the Mogadorian instead. If one of them tried the same thing with a knife on me right now, I would be killed. I push the thought away and ask, "Do you think they're still in paradise?" She says nothing for a minute, and when she finally speaks, I wish she had stayed silent instead.
"I think they might be."
"So, Sarah's in danger."
"Everyone's in danger, John. Every person we know in paradise, every person we don't know in paradise."
"All of paradise is probably under surveillance. and I know it's not safe to go within 50 miles of it, or to call, or even to send a letter, or they'd learn the pull Sarah has on me, the connection we have.
Anyway, Sam says, wanting to get back to the story, the Mogadorian accountant falls to the floor and dies. Then what?
Katerina threw the chest to me and grabbed our suitcase, and we sprinted out of the motel room, Katerina still in her robe. The truck was unlocked, and we jumped inside. Another Moog came charging out from behind the motel. Kat was so flustered that she couldn't find the keys. She locked the doors, though, and the windows were rolled up. But the guy wasted no time at all, and punched straight through the passenger side glass and grabbed me by the shirt. Katerina screamed, and some men nearby jumped into action. Others poured out of the diner to see what was happening. The Mogadorian had no choice but to let go of me to face the men. "The keys are in the motel room," Katerina yelled. She looked at me with these big, huge, desperate eyes. She was panicking. We both were. I jumped out of the truck and sprinted back to our room for the keys. Those men in Texas? They were the only reason we got away then. They saved our lives. When I came out of the motel room with the keys, one of the Texans was aiming a gun at the Mogadorian. We have no idea what happened after that, because Katerina sped away and we didn't look back. We hid the chest a few weeks later, right before they caught up to us for good.
"Don't they already have the chests from the first three?" Sam asks.
"I'm sure they do, but what use are they? The second we die, the chest unlocks itself and everything inside becomes useless," she says.
And I nod, knowing that much from past conversations with Henri.
"Not only are the objects worthless," I say, "but they completely disintegrate the same way the Mogadorians do when they're killed."
"Wicked," Sam says.
And then I remember the sticky note I found when saving Henri in Athens, Ohio. Those guys Henri visited, who ran the They Walk Among Us magazine.
"Yeah?"
"They had this source who apparently caught a Mogadorian and tortured it for information. And he supposedly knew that number 7 was being trailed in Spain, and that number 9 was somewhere in South America."
Six thinks about it a moment.
She bites her lip and glances in the rearview mirror.
"I know for a fact that number 7 is a girl. I remember that much from the ride in the ship."
The second this leaves her mouth, a siren blares behind us.
Chapter 5. The snow stops on Saturday night. The scraping sound of shovels against asphalt fills the night air. From the window, I can see the faint silhouettes of residents throwing snow to less cumbersome places, readying themselves for the morning walk for Sunday obligations. There's a certain tranquility to the town at work on a quiet night, everyone bound by the same cause, and I wish I was out there among them. And then the bedtime bell tolls. In the room, 14 girls find their beds within the minute, and the lights are shut off. The second I close my eyes, the dream begins. I stand in a field of flowers on a warm summer day. To my right, in the distance, the outline of jagged mountain range stands against the backdrop of the setting sun. To my left lies the sea. A girl, dressed in black, with raven hair and striking gray eyes, appears out of nowhere. She wears a smile, both fierce and confident. It's just the two of us. Then a great disturbance kicks up behind me, as though an isolated earthquake has just begun, and the ground is split open and torn apart. I don't turn to see what's actually happening. The girl lifts her hand, beckoning me to take it, her eyes locked on mine. I reach for it. My eyes open. Light streams in through the windows. While it feels as though minutes have passed, In reality, the whole night has gone by. I shake my head free of the dream. Sunday is the day of rest, though ironically for us, it's the busiest day of the week, starting with a long mass. Ostensibly, the large Sunday crowd is because of religious devotion within the community, but really, it's because of El Festín, the grand dinner that follows mass. All of us who live here must work it. My place is in the cafeteria line. It's only after dinner that we're finally free. If I'm lucky, we'll finish by 4. Then we're not due back until the sun sets. This time of year, it comes a little after 6. We rush to the showers, quickly bathe, brush our teeth and our hair, then dress in our Sunday best, identical black and white outfits that leave only our hands and heads showing. When most of the other girls have fled the room, Adelina walks in. She stands in front of me and fixes the neck of my tunic. It makes me feel much younger than I really am. I can hear the throng of people filing into the nave. Adelina remains silent. So do I. I look at the gray streaks in her auburn hair, which I hadn't noticed before. There are wrinkles at her eyes and mouth. She's 42, but looks 10 years older. I had a dream about a girl with raven hair and gray eyes who reached her hand out to me, I say, breaking the silence. She wanted me to take it. Okay, she says, unsure of why I'm telling her about a dream. Do you think she could be one of us? She gives the collar a final tug. I think you shouldn't read into your dream so much. I want to argue with her, but I'm not sure what to say. So instead I utter, it felt real. Some dreams do. But you said a long time ago that on Lorien we could sometimes communicate with each other over long distances. Yes, and right after that I would read you stories about a wolf who could blow down houses and a goose who laid golden eggs. Those were fairy tales. It's all one big fairy tale, Marina. I grit my teeth. How can you say that? We both know it's not a fairy tale. We both know where we came from and why we're here. I don't know why you act as if you didn't come from Lorien and you don't have a duty to teach me. She puts her hands behind her back and looks at the ceiling. Marina, since I've been here, since we've been here, we've been fortunate to learn the truth about creation and where we came from and what our real mission is on Earth. And that's all found in the Bible. And the Bible isn't a fairy tale? Her shoulders stiffen. She furrows her brows and flexes her jaw. Lorien isn't a fairy tale, I say, before she can respond. And using telekinesis, I lift a pillow from a nearby bed and spin it in the air. Adelina does something she's never done before. She slaps me. Hard! I drop the pillow and press my hand to my stinging cheek with my mouth wide open. Don't you dare let them see you do that, she says furiously. What I did right there, that's not a fairy tale. I'm not part of a fairy tale. You are my Sapon, and you are not part of a fairy tale. Call it what you will, she says. But haven't you read the news? You know the boy in Ohio is one of us. You have to. He could be our only chance. Our only chance at what? She asks. A life. And what do you call this? Spending our days living the lies of an alien race is no life, I say. She shakes her head. Give it up, Marina, she says, and walks away. I have no choice but to follow. Marina. The name sounds so normal now. So me. I don't think twice when Adelina hisses the name at me, or when one of the other girls in the orphanage yells it on the way out the school doors, waving my forgotten math book. But it hasn't always been my name. Back when we were aimlessly looking for a warm meal or a bed, back before Spain and Santa Teresa, before Adelina was Adelina, I had been Genevieve. Adelina was Odette. Those were our French names, We should change our names with every new country, Adelina had whispered when she was Signy and we were in Norway, where our ship landed after months at sea. She'd chosen Signy because it had been written on the woman's shirt behind the counter. What should my name be? I'd asked. Whatever you want it to be, she'd said. We'd been at a cafe in the middle of a bleak village, enjoying the heat from the mug of hot chocolate we'd shared. Signy had stood and retrieved the weekend's newspaper from a nearby table. On the front page was the most beautiful woman I'd ever seen. Blonde hair, high cheekbones, deep blue eyes. Her name was Birgitta. My name had become Birgitta. Even when we were on a train and the country zipped past the window like trees, we'd always changed our names, if just for a few hours. Yes, it was to stay hidden from the Mogadorians, or anyone else who might be following us. But it was also the one thing that raised our spirits among so much disappointment. I'd thought it was so much fun. I wish we'd traveled over Europe several times. In Poland, I was Minka, and she chose Zali. She was Fatima in Denmark, and I was Yasmin. I had two names in Austria, Sophie and Astrid. She fell in love with Emelina. Why Emelina? I'd asked. She laughed. I don't know exactly. I guess I love that it's almost two names in one. Either one is beautiful, but you smash them together and you get something extraordinary. In fact, I wonder now if that was the last time I heard her laugh, or the last time we hugged, or made proclamations about our destinies. I believe it was the last time I sensed she cared about being my Sapan, or what happened to Lorien, what happened to me. We arrive at Mass just before it begins. The only available seats are in the very last row, which is where I prefer to sit anyhow. Adelina shuffles to the front, where the sisters sit. Father Marco, the priest, begins with an opening prayer in his always somber voice, and most of his words are muffled beyond recognition by the time they reach me. I like it this way, sitting through Mass with detached apathy. I try not to think about Adelina smacking me, filling my mind instead with what I will do when Elphestine finally ends. None of the snow has melted, but I'm determined to make it to the cave anyway. I have something new to paint, and I want to finish the picture of John Smith that I started last week. Mass drags on forever. Or at least it feels that way. With rites, liturgies, communion, reading, prayers, rituals. When we reach the final prayer, I am exhausted, and don't even bother pretending to pray like I normally do. And instead, sit there with my head lifted and eyes open, scanning the backs of the heads of those in attendance. Almost all of them are familiar. One man sleeps upright in his pew, arms crossed and chin touching his chest. I watch him until something in his dream startles him awake with a grunt. Several heads turn his way as he gathers his bearings. I can't help but smile, and as I look away, my eyes find Sister Dora scowling at me. I drop my head, close my eyes, and feign prayer, mouthing the words that Father Marco recites up front. But I know I've been caught. It's what Sister Dora thrives on. She goes out of her way to catch us in the act of doing something we shouldn't. Prayer concludes with the sign of the cross, finally bringing an end to Mass. I'm up out of my seat before anyone else, and I hurry from the nave to the kitchen. Sister Dora may be the largest among all the sisters, but she shows surprising agility when it's needed, and I don't want to give her the chance to catch me. If she doesn't, I might escape punishment. And I do, because when she enters the cafeteria 5 minutes later as I'm peeling potatoes beside a gangly 14-year-old named Paola and her 12-year-old sister Lucia, she only glares at me. What's up with her? Paola asks. She caught me smiling during Mass. Good thing you weren't paddled, Lucia says out of the corner of her mouth. I nod and go back to what I'm doing, As fleeting as they are, it's these small moments that bring us girls together. The fact that we share a common enemy. When I was younger, I thought commonalities like this and of being orphaned and living under the same tyrannical roof would unite us all as immediate and lifelong friends. But really, it only worked to further divide us, creating small factions within our already small group. The pretty girls, huddling together, LaGuardia accepted, but still a part of their crowd. The smart girls, the athletic ones, the young ones. Until I was left all alone. A half hour later, when everything's ready, we carry the food from the kitchen to the serving line. The crowd of waiting people clap. At the back of the line, I see my favorite person in all of Santa Teresa, Hector Ricardo. His clothes are dirty and wrinkled, and his hair is tousled. He has bloodshot eyes and almost scarlet complexion to his face and cheeks. Even from as far away as I am, I notice he has a slight shake in each hand, as he always does on Sundays, the only day in the week he swears off drinking. He looks especially rough today, though when he finally approaches, he holds his tray out and fixes on his face the most optimistic smile he can muster.
"And how are you, my dear Queen of the Sea?" he asks.
I curtsy in return. "I'm doing well, Hector. And you?"
He shrugs, then says, "Life is but a fine wine, to be sipped and savored."
I laugh. Hector always has some old adage to share. I first met Hector when I was 13. He had been sitting outside the lone cafe on Calle Principal, drinking a bottle of wine by himself. It was mid-afternoon, and I had been on my way home from school. Our eyes met as I passed.
"Marina, as of the sea," he had said,
and I'd found it odd that he knew my name, though I shouldn't have, since I'd seen him every week at the church pretty much since the day I'd arrived.
"Come keep a drunk man company a few minutes."
I did. I'm not sure why. Maybe because there's something entirely agreeable about Hector. He makes me feel relaxed, and doesn't pretend to be somebody he isn't like so many other people do. He exudes the attitude of, "This is who I am, take it or leave it." That first day, we had sat and talked long enough for him to finish one bottle of wine and order a second.
"You stick with Hector Ricardo,"
he had said when I had to get back to the convent.
"I'll take care of you. It is in my name. The Latin root of Hector means to defend and hold fast. And Ricardo means power and bravery," he'd said, thumping his chest twice with his right fist. "Hector Ricardo will take care of you."
I could tell he meant it. He'd gone on.
"Marina, of the sea. That's what your name means. Did you know that?"
I told him I did not. I'd wondered what Birgitta meant. And Yasmin, what Emelina was rooted in.
"That means you are Santa Teresa's own sea queen," he had said with a sideways grin. I'd laughed at him.
"I think you've been drinking too much, Hector Ricardo."
"Yes," he had replied. "I am the town drunk, dear Marina, but don't let that fool you. Hector Ricardo is a defender all the same. And besides, show me a man without vice, and I'll show you one without virtue."
Years later, he's one of the few people I can call a friend. It takes 25 minutes for the few hundred people to receive their due today. And after the last person leaves the line, it's our turn to eat, sitting away from the others. As a group, we eat as fast as we can, knowing that the quicker we clean up and get everything put away, the sooner we'll be on our own. 15 minutes later, The five of us who worked the line are scraping pots and pans and wiping counters. At its best, cleanup takes an hour, and that's only if everyone leaves the cafeteria after they're done eating, which rarely happens. As we're cleaning, when I know the others aren't looking, I throw into a bag the non-perishable items I plan to take to the cave today. Dried fruits and berries, nuts, a can of tuna fish, a can of beans. This has become another weekly tradition of mine. For a long time, I convinced myself I was doing it so I could snack when painting the cave's walls. But the truth is, I'm creating a stockpile of food in case the worst arrives and I have to hide. And by the worst, I mean them. Chapter 6. When I finally walk outside after changing into warmer clothes and rolling my bed blanket under my arm, the sun is shifted to the west, and there's not a cloud in the sky. It's 4:30, which gives me an hour and a half at best. I hate the rushed quality of Sundays, the way the day creeps by until the very moment we're free, at which point time flies. I look to the east, and the light reflected off the snow causes me to squint. The cave is over two rocky hills. With as much snow as there is on the ground now, I'm not even sure I'll see the opening today. But I pull on my hat, zip up my jacket, tie the blanket around my neck like a cape, and head east. Two tall birch trees mark the trail's start, and my feet turn cold the second I enter the deep drifts. The blanket cape sweeps the snow behind me, erasing my footprints. I pass a few recognizable fixtures that show the way. A rock jutting out past the others. A tree that leans at a slightly different angle. After about 20 minutes, I pass the rock formation identical to a camel's back, which tells me I'm almost there. I have the faint sensation of being watched, possibly followed. I turn and scan the mountainside. Silence. Snow. Nothing else. The blanket around my neck has done a great job of hiding my tracks. A slow, prickly feeling crawls up the back of my neck. I've seen the way rabbits blend into the landscape, going unnoticed until you're almost on top of them. And I know that just because I can't see somebody doesn't mean they can't see me. 5 minutes later, I finally spot the rounded shrub that blocks the entrance. The cave's mouth looks like an oversized groundhog hole cutting into the mountain, and that's exactly what I had mistaken it for years ago. But when I'd look more closely, I knew I was wrong. The cave was deep and dark, and back then, I could see next to nothing in the little light that entered. There was an implicit desire to discover the cave's secrets. And I wonder if this is what caused the legacy to develop. My ability to see in the dark. I can't see in the dark as easily as I can see in the day. But even the deepest recesses of black glow as though lit by candlelight. On my knees, I knock away just enough snow to be able to slip down and in. I drop the bag ahead of me, untie the blanket from my neck, and sweep it across the snow to hide my footprints, then hang it on the other side of the opening to keep out the wind. The entrance is narrow for the first 3 meters, followed by a slightly wider passageway that winds down a steep decline large enough to navigate while standing. And after that, the cave opens, revealing itself. The ceiling is high and echoing, and its five walls smoothly transition into one another, creating an almost perfect polygon. A stream cuts through the back right corner. I have no idea where the water comes from or where it goes, springing up through one of the walls only to disappear into the earth's deeper depths. But the level never changes, offering a reservoir of icy cold water regardless of the time of day or season. With a constant fresh source of water, this is the perfect place to hide. From the Mogadorians, the sisters, and the girls, even Adelina. It's also the perfect place to use and hone my legacies. I drop the bag beside the stream, remove the non-perishables, and place them on the rock ledge, which already holds several chocolate bars, small bags of granola, oatmeal, cereal, powdered milk, a jar of peanut butter, and various cans of fruits, vegetables, and soup. Enough for weeks. Only when everything is put away do I stand and allow myself to be greeted by the landscapes and faces I've painted on the walls. From the very first time a brush was put into my hand at school, I fell in love with painting. Painting allows me to see things as I want to, and not necessarily as they are. It's an escape, a way to preserve thoughts and memories, a way to create hopes and dreams. I rinse the brushes, rubbing the stiffness from the bristles, and then mix the paint with water and sediment from the creek bed, creating earthy tones that match the gray of the cave's walls. Then I walk to where John Smith's partially completed face greets me with his uncertain grin. I spend a lot of time on his dark blue eyes, trying to get them just right. There's a certain glint that's hard to replicate, and when I tire of trying, I start on a new painting, that of the girl with the raven hair I had dreamed about. Unlike John's eyes, I have no trouble at all with hers, letting the gray wall do its magic, and I think that if I were to wave a lighted candle in front of it, the color would slightly change, as I'm sure her eyes do, depending on her mood and the light around her. It's just a feeling I get. The other faces I've painted are Hector's, Adelina's, a few of the town's vendors I see every weekday. Because this cave is so deep and dark, I believe my paintings are safe from anyone's eyes but mine. It's still a risk, I know, but I just can't help myself. After a while, I go up and push aside my blanket, poking my head out of the cave. I see nothing but drifts of white and the bottom of the sun kissing the horizon line, which tells me it's time to go. I haven't painted nearly as much or as long as I would have liked. Before cleaning the brushes, I walk to the wall opposite John and look at the big red square I've painted there. Before it was a red square, I'd done something foolish, something I know would have exposed me as a guard, and painted a list. I touch the square and think of the first three numbers that are underneath, running my fingertips over the dried, crack paint, deeply saddened by what those lines meant. If there's any consolation in their deaths, it's that they can now rest easy and no longer have to live in fear. I turn from the square, from the hidden and destroyed list, clean the brushes, and put everything away. "I'll see you guys next week," I say to the faces. Before leaving the cave, I take in the landscape painted on the wall beside the passageway leading in and out. It's the first painting I'd ever attempted here, sometime around the age of 12. And while I have touched it up a bit over the years, mostly it has remained the same. It's the view of Lorien from my own bedroom window, and I still remember it perfectly. Rolling hills and grassy plains, accentuated with tall trees. A thick slice of blue river that cuts across the terrain. Small bits of paint here and there that represent the Chimera drinking from its cool waters. And then, off in the far distance, at the very top, standing tall over the nine archways representing the planet's nine elders, is the statue of Pittacus Lore. So small, it's almost indistinct, but there's no mistaking it for what it really is, standing out among the others, a beacon of hope. I hurry from the cave and back to the convent, keeping an eye open for anything out of place. The sun is just below the horizon when I leave the path, which means I'm running late. I push through the heavy oak doors to find the welcome bells ringing. Somebody new has arrived. I join the others on their way to our sleeping quarters. We have a welcoming tradition here. Standing next to our beds, with our hands behind our backs, facing the new girl and introducing ourselves one by one. I'd hated it when I'd first arrived. Hated feeling on display when all I wanted to do was hide. In the doorway, standing beside Sister Lucia, is a small girl with auburn hair, curious brown eyes, and petite features not unlike a mouse. She stares at the stone floor, shifting her weight uncomfortably from one leg to the other. Her fingers fiddle with the waist of her gray wool dress, which is patterned with pink flowers. There's a small pink clip in her hair, and she wears black shoes with silver buckles. I feel sorry for her. Sister Lucia waits for us all to smile. All 37 of us. And then she speaks.
This is Ella. She is 7 years old and will be staying with us from here on out. I trust that you will all make her feel welcome.
A rumor is later whispered that her parents had been killed in an automobile accident, and she's here because she has no other relatives. Ella flutters her eyes up as each person says their name, but mostly she keeps her gaze on the floor. It's obvious she's scared and sad, but I can tell she's the kind of girl people will fall for. She won't be here for very long. We all walk to the nave together, so Sister Lucia can explain to Ella its importance to the orphanage. Gabby Garcia stands yawning in the back of the group, and I turn to look at her. Just beyond Gabby, framed in one of the clear panes of the stained glass window at the far wall, a dark figure stands outside looking in. I can just make him out in the oncoming nightfall. His black hair, heavy brows, and thick mustache. His eyes are trained on me. There's no doubt about it. My heart skips a beat. I gasp and take a step backwards. Everyone's head snaps around.
Marina, are you okay?
Sister Lucia asks.
Nothing, I say, then shake my head. I mean, yes, I'm fine, sorry.
My heart pounds and my hands shake. I clasp them together so it's not noticeable. Sister Lucia says something else about welcoming Ella, but I'm too distracted to hear it. I turn back to the window. The figure is gone. The group's dismissed. I rush across the nave and look outside. I don't see anyone, but I do see a single set of boot prints in the snow. I step away from the window. Perhaps it's a potential foster parent assessing the girls from afar. Or perhaps it's one of the girls' real parents, sneaking a glance at the daughter he can't provide for. But for some reason, I don't feel safe. I don't like the way his eyes settled on me.
Are you okay?
I hear behind me. I jump, then turn around. It's Adelina, standing with her hands clasped in front of her waist. A rosary dangles from her fingers.
Yes, I'm fine, I say.
You look like you've seen a ghost.
Worse than a ghost, I think.
But I don't say that. I'm scared after this morning's slap, and I pocket my hands.
There was somebody at the window watching me, I whisper. Just now.
Her eyes squint.
Look! Look at the prints,
I say, turning back and motioning to the ground. Adelina's back is straight and rigid, and for a moment, I think she's actually concerned. But then she softens and steps forward. She takes in the prints.
I'm sure it's nothing, she says.
What do you mean it's nothing? How can you say that?
I wouldn't worry. It could have been anyone.
He was looking right at me.
Marina, wake up. With today's new arrival, there are 38 girls here. We do the best we can keeping you girls safe, but that doesn't mean the occasional boy from town doesn't wander up here to sneak a peek. We've even caught some of them. And don't think for a minute we don't know the way that some of the others dress, changing clothes on the walk to school to look provocative. There are 6 of you turning 18 soon, and everyone in town knows it. So, I wouldn't worry about the man you saw. He was probably nothing more than a boy from school.
I'm sure this was no boy from school, but I don't say so. Anyway, I wanted to apologize for this morning. It was wrong of me to strike you. It's okay, I say. And for a minute, I think of bringing John Smith up again, but I decide against it. It would create more friction, which I want to avoid. I miss the way we used to be, and it's hard enough living here without having Adelina angry at me. Before she says anything further, Sister Dora hurries over and whispers something into Adelina's ear. Adelina looks at me and nods and smiles. We'll talk later, she says. They walk away, leaving me to myself. I look back down at the boot prints, and a shiver runs up my back. For the next hour, I pace from room to room, looking down the hill at the dark town cast in shadow, but I don't see the looming figure again. Perhaps Adelina is right. But no matter how hard I try convincing myself, I don't think she is.
Chapter 7. Silence falls in the truck. 6 glances in the rearview mirror. Flashing red and blue plays along her face.
Not good, Sam says. Shit,
6 says. The bright lights and screaming siren rouse even Bernie Kosar, who peers out the back window.
What do we do?
Sam asks, his voice frightened and desperate. 6 takes her foot off the accelerator and steers the truck to the right side of the highway.
It might mean nothing,
she says. I shake my head. Doubtful.
Wait, why are we stopping? Sam asks. Don't stop, step on it.
Let's see what happens first. We'll never make it if we lead this cop on a high-speed chase. He'll call for backup, and they'll get a helicopter. Then we'll never get away.
Bernie Kosar begins growling. I tell him to chill out, and he stops. But he keeps vigil out the window. Gravel pings against the truck as we slow along the shoulder. Cars speed past in the left lanes. The cop car pulls to within 10 feet of our rear bumper, and its headlights fill the truck's interior. The cop flips them off, then aims a spotlight straight through the rear window. The siren stops wailing, but the lights still flash.
What do you think? I ask, watching from the side mirror.
The spotlight is blinding, but when a car passes, I can see that the officer is holding the radio up in his right hand, probably running our license plate, or calling for backup.
Our best bet is to flee on foot, 6 says, if that's what it comes to.
Turn off your vehicle and remove the key from the ignition,
the cop barks through a speaker. 6 turns off the truck. She looks at me and removes the key. If he radios us in, you have to assume they'll hear it, I say. She nods. Says nothing. From behind us, the officer's car door creaks. His approaching boots click bleakly on the asphalt.
Do you think he'll recognize us?
Sam asks.
Shh,
6 says. When I look in the side mirror again, I realize the officer isn't walking towards the driver's side, and has instead veered right and is coming towards me. He taps my window with his chrome flashlight. I hesitate for a moment, then roll it down. He shines the light in my face, causing me to squint. Then he moves the beam to Sam, then 6. He forces his brows together, studying each of us closely while he tries to determine why we look so familiar.
Is there a problem, officer?
I ask.
You kids from around here?
No, sir.
You care telling me why y'all's driving through Tennessee in a Chevy S10 with North Carolina plates belonging to a Ford Ranger?
He glares at me, waiting for an answer.
My face feels warm as I struggle to find one. I have nothing.
The officer bends down and again flashes the light on Six, then at Sam.
"Anyone want to try me?"
he asks. He's met with silence, which causes him to chuckle.
"Of course not," he says. "Three kids from North Carolina driving through Tennessee in a stolen truck on a Saturday night. You kids are on a dope run, aren't you?"
I turn and stare into his face, which is ruddy and clean-shaven.
"What do you want to do?" I ask.
"What do I want to do? You kids are going to jail."
I shake my head at him. "I wasn't talking to you." He leans forward with his elbows on the door.
"So where's the dope?"
he says, and then sweeps the flashlight across the interior of the truck. He stops when the light hits the chest at my feet. Then a smug smile spreads along his lips.
"Well, never mind. Looks like I found it myself."
He reaches to open the door. In one lightning-quick motion, I shoulder open the door and knock the officer backwards. He grunts and moves for his gun before he even hits the ground. Using telekinesis, I rip it away, bringing it to me as I step out. I open the chamber and empty the bullets into my hand and snap the gun shut.
"What the?"
The officer is dumbfounded. "We're not dealing dope," I say. Sam and Six are out of the truck now and standing beside me. "Put these in your pocket," I say to Sam, handing him the bullets. Then I hand him the gun.
"What do you want me to do with this?" Sam asks.
"I don't know. Put it in your bag with your dad's gun." Off in the distance, 2 miles away, the whine of a second siren reaches me. The officer stares intently at me, his eyes wide in recognition.
"Oh, hell, you the boys from the news, aren't you? Y'all are those terrorists,"
he says and spits on the ground.
"Shut up," Sam says. "We're not terrorists."
I turn around and grab Bernie Kosar, who's still in the cab because of his broken leg. As I'm lowering him to the ground, an agonizing scream rips through the night. I jerk around and see Sam convulsing, and it takes a second to realize what's happened. The officer has tasered him. I tear the taser from him while I'm 10 feet away. Sam falls to the ground and shakes as though he's having a seizure.
"What the hell is the matter with you?" I yell at the officer. "We're trying to save you. Don't you see that?"
Confusion crosses his face. I press the button of the taser as it hovers in the air. Blue currents snap across the top of it. The cop scrambles away. I use telekinesis to drag him through the pebbles and trash on the side of the road. He kicks and tries in vain to get away.
"Please,"
he begs.
"I'm sorry. I'm sorry."
"Don't, John,"
Six says. I refuse to listen to her. I'm blind to anything other than retribution, and I don't feel a shred of remorse as I slam the taser into the officer's gut and hold it there for a full 2 seconds.
"How do you like it, huh? Big, tough guy with a taser. Why can't anyone see we're not the bad guys?"
He shakes his head, his face locked in a horrified grimace, sweat beads glistening on his forehead.
"We have to get out of here fast,"
Six says as the red and blue lights of the second police car appear on the horizon. I lift Sam and pull him over my shoulder. Bernie Kosar is able to run on his own on only 3 legs. I carry the chest under my left arm while Six carries everything else.
"This way,"
she says, jumping over the guardrail and entering a barren field leading to the dark hills a mile away. I sprint as fast as I can with Sam in the chest. Bernie Kosar tires of hobbling and morphs into a bird and speeds ahead of us. Not a minute later,
The second car arrives on the scene, followed by a third. I can't tell if the officers are pursuing us on foot, but if they are, Six and I can easily...